We're going to be reading from James chapter 4, verses 11, down to chapter 5, verse 6. If you could open up in the Church Family Bibles to page 1013. Do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is only one lawgiver and judge, he who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you.
Well, James, thanks for reading. And let me add my welcome to Rob's. Great to see you. Great to see you, especially if this is your first week with us in James. Welcome. I'm not sure there has been an easy week to join us in James. And no doubt from today's passage alone, you'll realize that James says what he thinks. He doesn't hold back. He is warning us against hypocritical, adulterous Christianity, which he has termed double-minded. Instead, he wants to bring us back to the wisdom from above, to be transformed by God's wisdom. And people have often said that James sounds like wisdom literature. I was thinking for this week, if I had to come up with a proverb to kind of fit with today's passage, what would I choose? And undoubtedly, it would be Proverbs 16, verse 18, which says this, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Almost exactly a year ago today, a study was published entitled, Does Pride Really Come Before a Fall? Its aim was to test whether high levels of reported pride really did associate with how often adults fall over. Interestingly, they concluded that pride was often a protective factor against falling over in older adults. But James isn't talking about falling over. He's not even just concerned with falling in this life. James is worried that we might totally fall out of our relationship with God into worthless religion. Religion that cannot save our souls from death. And last Sunday, he pointed us to the solution at the root of the problem. And it's verse 10. I've put it on your sheets if you're following along on the handout. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. So this week, James gives us three areas for self-inspection. Each time, no doubt, there's sin for all of us to mourn. But it's not just on the surface. Track each of them back to the source, and there is disbelief about God and preoccupation with self. Self-interest, self-importance, self-exaltation. So firstly, stop self-promoting slander. Verse 11. Do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is only one lawgiver and judge, he who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? Now, just to be clear, James isn't saying there should be no discernment in church. In fact, James himself has clearly called them out on their double-mindedness. So that must in some way be a sort of judgment. But this appears to be self-promoting slander as we exalt ourselves over one another. You might remember the story Rob told a couple of weeks ago about the history professor who was anonymously criticizing his competitor's works on Amazon while giving himself positive reviews. Well, the review site Which seems to have built their latest campaign ads on that problem. Fran took this photo on the tube the other day. How to spot the fake reviews from the real ones. I quite like the suspiciously enthusiastic with an overabundance of amazing superlatives, far too many capital letters, and an overkill of screaming exclamations. But most appropriate for this passage, I think, is the one-star review. I don't know if you can see it. I'm probably standing in the way. There's a one-star review there, and it says, "And what's worse, some fakes are deliberately negative to make honest competitors look bad." Well, their slogan is "facts, not fake reviews." And they try to warn us, with our best interests at heart, I'm sure, that other review sites can't be trusted. Instead, their solution is to sign up to a Which membership. Now, obviously, this is an advert, so they don't have to bother disguising their self-promotion as they try to make their honest competitors look bad. But it is the way of the world generally. Rubbish the competition and elevate yourself. I'll steer clear of politics this weekend, but I have read the words leadership contest a number of times over the last few days. But say there's only one job at the end of the grad scheme. A few carefully chosen words could make me the obvious choice for them to employ instead of the other person. Who should be put forward for full-time ministry? Well, have I told you about the quiet times I'm doing in the Book of Lamentations recently? James has already challenged us this series about the use of our tongues. The restless evil, he called it, setting on fire the entire course of life and set on fire by hell. He's not exaggerating either, if its source is the demonic wisdom. And here we can see that that demonic wisdom has persuaded us to forget that God is the rightful lawgiver and judge, verse 12, not me. In the words that I use to criticize another person and compliment myself as I judge them in order to distinguish myself. I think we could so easily frame it as godly concern. Have you heard about him? He's really struggling at the moment, but I'm trying to get alongside him. Or maybe we hide our gossip in an accountability group. I think if you are good enough at this, you could even work it into your prayer life. So the prayers that we pray for each other at the end of midweek, as you pray someone else down and just enjoy occupying the kind of holy vacuum that you've created for yourself. Well, firstly, I've totally forgotten my place, haven't I? Who are you to judge your neighbour, says James. He's happy to lend a helping, humbling hand. I've forgotten that I too sit under God's judgment and should be humbled in the knowledge that I need his grace, having broken his law to love my neighbour as myself. I'm dependent on him as the only one able to save and destroy. And my pride not only gets in the way of me accepting his offer of salvation, but James says it is an attempt to supplant him as the judge. If you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. And there is only one lawgiver and judge. But also, the tragic irony was that God wanted to exalt me. In fact, you could write that next to each of our 3 points this morning. Let God exalt you. So often we choose the less attractive, more competitive, temporary self-exaltation. Well, James says, in doing so, you distance yourself from the one who can truly exalt you, the one able to save and destroy. Well, we'll carry on into James's second scenario, because we've only managed 2 verses so far, and the pattern is fairly similar each time. So verse 13, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Still need persuading of your double-mindedness? Well, look at how you speak about your future. James's second point for us is stop self-assured boasting. And I think this double-mindedness might normally slip under the radar. Self-assurance, self-reliance, self-confidence. Sometimes our world even thinks those are excellent things, good qualities in people. We can do this for ourselves. We can make it happen. Back when he was president, Obama said this in a speech to some school children. Where you are right now doesn't have to determine where you'll end up. No one's written your destiny for you. Here in America, you write your own destiny. You make your own future. This is the lie that's spread at every graduation, but also in campaign speeches and motivational pictures and blogs and self-help books and therapy sessions. So let's just take a look at some of them. I've got some pictures here. You are the creator of your own destiny. Try another one. The best way to predict your future is to create it. Clever. And one more. Today is the first step on the road to creating your own tomorrow. They're aiming to empower us. And it's not as if there's no truth to that. You do make choices in life. But ultimately, God is the creator of your destiny. The best way to predict your future is actually to listen to what God has revealed about your future. And focusing on creating your own tomorrow could well lead you to your humiliation as you fade away in the midst of your pursuits, like the rich man from chapter 1 in James. Do you remember the flower that withers and perishes and fades away? Sounds an awful lot like the mist which appears for a little time, then vanishes. You might well make a profit, but you don't know what tomorrow will bring. And it seems like you haven't factored God into your decision-making process at all. I had a really good conversation with someone here at Euston Church earlier this year, as they tried to think ahead as to where they might live and what they might do next year. James isn't saying don't plan, and instead just sort of make it up as you go along because, well, you know, God. But when you plan, do you think about the Lord's will? Do you ever imagine, for example, that he might not want you to make a profit this year? Because that wouldn't actually be good for you. How anxious or upset do you get when life doesn't seem to be going to plan? Well, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills. Now, we could take this too far and unhelpfully turn it into a bit of a joke. Join us afterwards for tea and coffee, if the Lord wills. I'm just going to the toilet, if the Lord wills. I don't think we need to say the words all the time, but I think we're much more in danger of not saying the words enough. God willing, I'll be a fully qualified lawyer by the end of this year. God willing, we move into our new house in 2 weeks. It's great to hear people at Easton saying that sort of thing. And obviously, God's not more in control of those big things than the tiny mundane details of life. But particularly when we speak about things which might carry more worldly significance, or when we speak to friends who aren't Christians, it would be really helpful for them to see and to remind ourselves that God is the one who knows what tomorrow will bring. Our life is a mist, fleeting, vanishing, difficult to hold on to before it dissipates. We don't know the future, and what could we do about it even if we did? Think less of yourself, think more of God, and put your trust in his plans for you. As we plan as a church for next year at Easton Church, whether we plant a new service or start a new midweek evening or employ a new member of staff, it's just worth us always humbling ourselves before the one who reveals the future, and because he wills it, he can actually make it happen. All the way through the Bible, the ability to promise things about the future and deliver on them has been one of God's signature moves. It separates him from worthless religion and the world's wisdom. And what a future he has promised to those who love him. A crown of life, chapter 1, verse 12. A kingdom where we will be heirs. We don't have to say, if the Lord wills, in front of those promises. He's already told us he wills them. God wants to exalt us far beyond what we deserve or imagine. Why are we so intent on taking matters into our own hands? Our efforts at self-exaltation, far from securing our success and making a profit, they are the very thing that might jeopardize our souls. Whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Hasn't James warned us about being hearers only and deceiving ourselves? The single-minded Christian doesn't boast in his self-assurance, but in the assurance of a Father with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change, and from whom you receive every good gift and every perfect gift. Well, thirdly, and James in no way slows down, calms down, or goes soft. Stop self-indulgent treasure hoarding. Look down with me at the end of verse 3 of chapter 5. You have laid up treasure in the last days. And then verse 5. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. Now, James uses language that I think we could find sort of very attractive, mixed with very unattractive. So treasure and luxury, they sound kind of fancy and desirable. But when we hear self-indulgent, it's clearly gone too far. It's gotten excessive. But even then, I'm not sure where we'd rank it on the kind of spectrum of sin. Of course you can have too much of a good thing, but how morally wrong really is it? Well, verse 1 of chapter 5 begins, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you." James has done this all the way through. He targets our so-called respectable sins, and he throws them into the category labelled evil, earthly, unspiritual, demonic. So just jump to verse 6, right at the end of today's reading. "You have condemned and murdered the righteous person." This isn't just a little naughty matter of overeating or indulging in some of the creature comforts of this life. James lumps you with the murderer. He deliberately uses that language. It's probably not literal murder. He wants us to get that this is serious double-mindedness. And James has no problem slapping us around the face with it until we realise the inconsistency and incompatibility of the self-indulgent Christian. "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire." I said he's not calming down. It's more like he's ramping it up again. He wants to knock some sense into us. Verse 4 is even more condemning. "Behold, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts." Once again, this is an example of self-exaltation at the expense of someone else. If you've read or watched the Hunger Games series, there's a scene where they're at the presidential palace in the capital. Everyone who's anyone has turned up, and there are tables laden with delicacies lining the walls. But they're also serving glasses of clear liquid. And when you drink them, they allow you to vomit up your previous meal to make space to go on eating. Now, it's gross. And even in the film, at the same time, elsewhere in the districts, the poor people who grow the crops and mow the fields, the labourers, they're starving because there's not enough food to go around. James told us back in chapter 1 that pure, undefiled religion would visit the orphan and the widow, would look after the needy and vulnerable. And yet here the labourers haven't been paid. The rich have committed fraud against them, and they are powerless to resist. And actually, it doesn't take long to find that sort of thinking in the world. But not just where there's overt corruption and oppression. A recent study found that 50% of the world's total wealth is owned by just 1% of the people. But would you find it in church? Would you find it in Euston Church? My tendency is to work on the assumption that I'm not like the person in the passage. I'm not living a life of luxury. I'm not committing fraud against a brother to indulge my comfortable lifestyle. James must be talking about other people in church, or maybe just other churches, the sort of people that live in Kensington or Mayfair, maybe Muswell Hill. But comparison to one another is hardly ever a good idea, not least because to be living, studying, working in London, in comparison to the rest of the world, we are the rich. So looking around and feeling like we're just sort of average, well, that's a very dangerous way to deceive ourselves. Just to warn you, I'm about to make a Christmas application, 37 days to go. But apparently last year, 4.2 million Christmas dinners were wasted across the United Kingdom, which is apparently equivalent to 263,000 turkeys, 7.5 million mince pies, 740,000 slices of Christmas pudding, 17.2 million Brussels sprouts, 11.9 million carrots, and 11.3 million roast potatoes. Add it up, and it amounts to about £64 million worth of wasted food each Christmas. Now, I won't be the person to decide whether you've crossed the line this Christmas. It's an exercise in self-inspection. But James is also a book with the aim of bringing back the sinner from his wandering. So maybe we can at least talk about that kind of thing together. How much do we genuinely need? And why is it so hard for us to leave it at that? Are we using our wealth to look after and care for other people? Or are we laying up our treasures to exalt ourselves? Remember, from last week, James thinks it might be appropriate to mourn our sin in this area. But from this passage, some people ought to go further. Weep and howl. Because having hoarded treasure for a life of luxury now, miseries are coming, and the Lord has been listening. Jack and the Beanstalk is one of my favourite English fairy tales. With the unforgettable line, "Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman." If you've never heard of it, it's actually a really terrible story about a boy who climbs a magic beanstalk into the sky, and he just steals treasure, which rightfully belongs to this giant. And then eventually, he kills the giant. Some very dubious morality in that story. But the third thing that Jack steals from the giant while he's asleep is a magic harp. And when he steals it, the harp cries out, "Master! Master!" and wakes the giant up because it's being stolen. How do you know that Jack is the thief? He's holding a harp that is shouting, "I've been stolen! This little boy's a massive thief!" "Behold, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you have kept back by fraud, are crying out against you." When God lines up the suspects, when the last days are finally over, how will they know it was you? Well, you'll be holding the incriminating evidence that is ready to dob you in, those treasures that you were laying up for yourself. But there's also another obvious way for God to pick you out of the lineup. Did you see it in verse 5? "You've lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter." What's the evidence of your self-indulgence? A fattened heart. All that time feasting and indulging, you fattened yourself up ready for the slaughter. And there's no use arguing when the day of slaughter comes, because the Lord of hosts has been listening the whole time. Verse 4, "The cries of the harvesters have reached his ears." You say you know God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. You say you know if you draw near to God, he will draw near to you. You say you know if you humble yourself before the Lord, he will exalt you. But what does the evidence show? All three of these behaviours we've looked at give us a window into basically the same area of our hearts. We could try to make ourselves look prettier on the outside, but James wants us to stop being double-minded, to abandon the worldly wisdom that has got us here, and to ask instead, what do I not trust God to do for me? What do I want from the world because I think I can't get it from God? And what has God already done for me that I've forgotten? Where do I have an inflated sense of self-importance? Too easily we buy the devil's lies. And instead of humbling ourselves so that God can exalt us, we exalt ourselves. It's the cheap, twisted version of something good God wants for us. Did you notice he started off calling them brothers back in verse 11? But since then, does that word come up a single time in our passage? It's actually one of the most common words in the whole book of James, but it barely makes an appearance in this passage. He is deliberately calling into question the authenticity of their faith. Are they even brothers anymore? Double-minded people who've wandered so far from the truth that their souls are well and truly in danger. No wonder they should weep and howl. Their treasures can't help them now. In fact, they are the very evidence crying out against them. Jesus said these words in Matthew's Gospel, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." James echoes Jesus' words in this passage. And his logic is so clear. A crown of life compared to riches that rot. Exalted as heirs of the kingdom compared to gold and silver that go rusty. How do you lay up those treasures in heaven? Well, humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you.